Blog Talk Radio.
Special to me. And the reason that it is special is because
Gerard Schaefer affected a lot of people's lives when he did what he did. Not just the victims. He affected the families. He affected their friends. He affected law enforcement. He even affected prosecution. He affected the judge. Tonight's show is called Silent Scream, The True Crime of the Murders of Deborah Lowe and 8 Other Victims. And tonight I have Deborah Lowe's sister as one of my guests. We will get to her in a moment. But the screams, which have been silent for 34 years, are no longer silent. They now have a voice. July 1972, Nancy Trotter and Pamela Sue Wells were taken to a remote area in South Hutchinson Island in Martin County. They were tied, gagged, and they were hung. They were left to die. But they managed to escape. This escape led to an investigation of a crime that before 1972 had no name. Law enforcement was in uncharted waters. The name of that crime? Serial killing. The killer, Gerard Schaefer. Nancy Trotter and Pamela Wells were just two of the 9 known and possibly as high as 34 unknown victims. They ranged from Fort Lauderdale, Florida to Europe and North Africa. Silent Scream finally was able to give the victims a voice. So their screams are no longer silent, and with that voice, I hope, comes peace. Tonight's show, Eva Newsom, one of the siblings of Deborah Lowe, has agreed to come to the show in her story. It has been 35 years since Deborah, at the age of 13, appeared on her way to school. I'm going to start by introducing you to talking about Deborah. I want to read an excerpt from the book so that you, the listening audience, can understand and maybe get to know Deborah a little bit. Because I can see Deborah in my mind's eye, and she's a beautiful girl. Deborah was Gerard Schaefer's 7th victim. She was a brown-haired, brown-eyed child, and she was born September 19, 1958. She lived in Pompano Beach, Florida, a 20-minute ride north of Fort Lauderdale. She weighed 125 pounds and was 5 feet 5 inches tall. Her upper teeth were crowded together, and one of her front teeth had a small chip in it. She had a small scar on her left leg. She was last seen wearing a tan poncho, a yellow blouse, and black slacks with a vertical rose-colored stripes. The last time Deborah was seen was on February 28, 1972. She was seen walking to Rickards Middle School near 8th Street and Sunrise Boulevard in Pompano Beach between the hour of 7:30 and 8:30 in the morning. At first, law enforcement thought she had run away from her new home and back to Palestine, West Virginia. Her family had recently moved to Pompano from West Virginia. Her family didn't believe she would do that because she had no history of being a runaway and she left behind all of her personal belongings. Eva Newsom, my guest, Deborah's sister, said that the police encouraged her parents to tell them that Deborah was a runaway. She said in an interview that they didn't want to be bothered, and she's probably right. She also said the family finally got a copy of the Pompano Beach Police Department complaint form. It said that Mr. Lowe had stated Deborah might be headed for Palestine, West Virginia. The statement said she didn't have any friends in the area and was not allowed to date. Ms. Newsom believes that Deborah may have been another victim of Gerard Schaefer. Sadly, and probably because of Deborah's disappearance, Eva lost another family member. Her father died of a heart attack. The rest of the family still holds out hope, but her silent screams are still being heard. Eva, I want to thank you so much because I cannot even understand how difficult revisiting this might be for you. And I am humbled and I am honored that you have agreed to come on the show tonight. And maybe, just maybe, we might save one life. Welcome, my friend.
Thank you, Yvonne. Thanks for having us. Thanks for having me. Thanks for sharing your information and helping our family as much as you have, as we also seek answers and just hope that somebody listening tonight will be able to give us the emphatic closure that we need with regard to Debbie's disappearance, and we believe her murder.
And what makes this so difficult, ladies and gentlemen, is that while the family physically moves forward, emotionally, it is difficult to move forward because they're stuck in 1972 because they were not allowed to tell their sister goodbye. Would that be a true statement, Eva?
That is correct. It's actually been very tough. I guess I'm blessed in a sort because I was so young when it happened. It was actually, she actually disappeared. I know it's always listed as February 28th, but oddly enough, she did disappear on the leap year day, February 29th. And that morning, she and my brother, who was close in age with her, were walking to school together. They would walk a certain distance together, and then they would separate because she went on to the middle school. And he remembers how he would always turn around and watch her until she was out of sight. And that morning was no different. He said he would turn around and look several times and always see her walking. And then he didn't see her anymore, just like every other day. But when he came home from school, she wasn't there. And just as you and I talked in pre-show, a lot of things have changed today that it may be hard for people to understand what we went through back then. Because today, being a parent of a child, the middle school would call me if my son did not make it to school, and things would immediately happen. The police would be notified. There would be
We have apparently lost Eva. Maybe she'll come back with us. Sometimes that happens with live radio. We lost her signal, so hopefully she'll come back and join us. I'm still showing her as being active, but she's sort of faded out. But what she was saying is this family was not notified the day that Deborah disappeared. Nobody knew anything until she didn't come home. And also, what is sad is that there she is. Let's get her back.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure. Hello?
Hey, Eva, you faded out on me, but that's okay. You're back. That happens with radio sometimes. Continue with your story.
Yes, I was just going to, back at the time that we lost Debbie, my mom, I know she was never notified that anything was amiss with Debbie. And then when she tried to notify the police, at that time there was a 24-hour wait period before they could file a missing persons report, the best that I understand it. And then they did treat her, because technically she was a teenager, though she was only 13, they would treat it as a runaway. And so my parents were never taken very seriously. And in fact, like often happens, they were given false reports by anonymous people that maybe she was spotted here or there. And my dad did act on one report and kind of busted into this house and demanded information. And he himself was almost arrested because of him doing that, where really, in today's world, and it should have been at that time, the police would have followed up on that report and investigated to determine if there was any validity to it. So at that time, my parents were treated very poorly, and it did not help that we were transplants. We were new to the area. We didn't have connection. There was no infrastructure in place to deal with the missing child, no resources for my parents. But strangely enough, my mom did notice. Then she started to notice things going on around her, started to notice the other missing girls, and eerily enough, their resemblance often to Debbie. She started keeping a scrapbook that my brother still has today. And many of those cases at the time that my parents left Florida had not been resolved. But later, really, is kind of what led my brother to the direction that we've gone to, because later when he followed up on those cases, some of them were directly linked to Gerard Schaefer. So it's as if my mother had that maternal instinct or some idea to realize that these things were not just distant from each other, that there was a connection. She did a good job. But both of my parents, my father died only 4 years later of a heart attack at 45, and my mom died she died several years ago as well, although she lived a little longer. But I believe now that hopefully they're all together and they know what happened to her. But unfortunately, they had to live the remainder of their life on this earth not knowing. And no parent should have to go through that. My brothers struggle a great deal because they lost her. They don't know what happened to her. They try very hard to know and understand. And there's just, when cases are cold, it's so hard to get any information. And we've been told by many people that there's probably enough just to say that Gerard Schaefer probably abducted her, but there's no body to say anybody murdered her. Well, we may never get that closure, and so my hope is that we could ever get that closure.
Well, what I found interesting once Will contacted me after the book came out is Schaefer was actually at your home.
Yes, my brothers believe that they remember a man that he did not use the name Gerard Schaefer. I believe he went by the name Jerry Shepherd or something to that effect. They remember him coming in as a friend of Dad's, and that was prior to Debbie's disappearance. And then later, after her disappearance, I believe that my brother Leroy remembers him coming back and trying to spend time talking to my mom, and kept wanting to send my brother into another room. And it was funny because he printed off this picture of Gerard Schaefer and took it to our oldest brother when he was starting to piece all this together and said, "Do you recognize this guy?" And Bobby goes, "Yeah, that's that Jerry Shepherd, that new dad." And my brother Leroy said, "Well, actually, his name's Gerard Schaefer." And so starts telling him the story and showing him all of the information. So that was a very scary and kind of an aha moment for my brothers together to piece that together. But I do believe that he probably, I believe, unless somebody can prove differently, that he probably had everything to do with my sister's disappearance and murder. But unfortunately, like most of his victims, there's not a lot of solid physical evidence, just because they're cold and because maybe the investigations weren't done the way they would be done today if there were a series of missing girls in an area.
Yeah, and the thing is, we also have to point out that at that particular time, ladies and gentlemen, police departments and sheriff's departments were all autonomous. They didn't talk to each other. They didn't share information because they were like a big fish in a little pond, and they jealously guarded their little fiefdom. So when something like this happened, number one, they didn't have the resources. They didn't have the database. They didn't have the technology. And number two, they didn't want to share information. And because Debbie's family was transplants, that was their first thought, which it should not have been, is that she had gone back to West Virginia because she wasn't happy. But for crying out loud, she was only 13 years old. And yes, that was also the time when girls hitchhiked and they left home and they did this and they did that. But Debbie's MO was not that. Debbie was very much loved. She was very much a homebody. And there was no reason for her to leave. Now, let's digress a little bit. Let's go back to some happier times. Tell me about, because y'all know, y'all been around me enough to know that I have a very spiritual connection to all nine of these girls because I lived with them for 2 years when I researched and wrote the book, and I've always said they drove this train. And they tell me when they want to be heard, and Susan Place and Georgia Joseph have been heard several times, and now it's Debbie's turn. So let's talk about Debbie, and tell child that you remember her and what she brought to the table as a family member.
I'm sorry, you're asking me to tell you about Debbie? I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
That's okay.
I have to rely, of course, on memories shared with me by my older brothers and sisters and my mom, just because I was so young, so I don't have any personal memories. But one of the things that I always love to hear them talk about is her bond with me, was her bond with me, because I was so much younger than her. They said that she was almost like a second mother to me. They said that she picked me up constantly, carried me around, played with me. They said that I seemed to almost be, you know, one of her favorite toys, that was something that she loved to do. So I always am glad that, you know, even though I may never have recall of those moments, that we did have that time together. There's a great picture that they have of the three of us, the only picture of the three of us girls together. My parents have bought each one of us a bathing suit, and so there's Debbie and her sister Annie and me standing together. And I know that she was very close to my brothers. She has one of my brothers, they're only 11 months apart, and his life was forever negatively impacted by her disappearance. I think he had a tremendous amount of guilt just because maybe he felt that he should have been able to protect her somehow. But I know that she was, you know, kind of a feisty girl, as I remember my mom talking about her, but I think very close to my mom, I would guess, just being the oldest girl. I know that my mom clearly never recovered from Debbie's disappearance. She looked a lot like my mom, with the dark hair and dark eyes, where my father was much lighter. And close to my brother Leroy, he was a few years younger than her, but he seemed to really look up to her and just took a lot of security from her presence and from them walking together. And I just think that it's just hard to describe the impact that it left on each member of the family in different ways. The older brothers, the guilt of not helping her, the younger brother, just the unanswered questions, just me growing up in an environment where one daughter had been missing, so my mom feeling very nervous and worried all the time of something happening to somebody else, and the unanswered questions. And I think my dad had a tremendous guilt, even because he moved us to Florida, even though there's no way he could have predicted something like that. But as parents, we always blame ourselves, and I think he blamed himself wrongly for that. So it just leaves a huge open hole that nobody can ever take the place of somebody else in a family. So where she should have been, it was a hole now, and that never was replaced. And I think that's tough, and I know by looking at the information about him that he did that possibly to a lot of families and maybe never was held accountable on this earth for all of that.
Let me ask you this. Well, let me rephrase that. Ladies and gentlemen, the guilt that these family members feel, of course, it's like Eva says, we know it is not justified. Mr. Newsom had no idea when he moved his family south that this could happen. Leroy was what, 11 years old? Had no idea when he left his sister at the split-off point that she would never return home. The elder brothers never, ever thought that they would lose their sister this way. So what Schaefer did is he not only destroyed Debbie's life, but he has impacted the life of this family for all times. The father unfortunately died at 45 years old. He was in the prime of his life. He didn't live to get to see his grandchildren. He didn't live to get to see his children's accomplishments, and that is wrong. Schaefer was an evil, evil, evil man, and anyone that says that they feel sorry for him has never lost a loved one to a killer, a cold-blooded killer. And when he integrated himself into their lives, and then kept integrating himself back into their lives after Debbie disappeared, he was hunting. for information. And the reason he kept trying to send the brother out of the room was because he knew the brother knew. And Eva, I really believe that. He knew that your brother, on some level, knew what he had done.
He probably did. You're probably right. And you want to know something very interesting that I always, for whatever reason, I find this very interesting. Our mother died the same year George Schaefer was murdered in prison.
Wow.
He was murdered. He was murdered on her birthday, as I understand. I believe, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I believe he was murdered December 3rd, 1995. Is that correct?
Wait just a minute, and I'll tell you. Because I have that information here. I just have to look it up. But carry on, and I'll look up the information.
Because our mother's birthday is December 3rd, and she died in 1995. She died December 23rd, 1995. I believe he died December 3rd, 1995. And I always want to believe that maybe that was God's way of, you know.
It's very possible. And I believe you're right. It was 95, and I believe it was December 3rd. Because yeah. the guy that killed him served the justice that the courts could not, and the only reason that Schaefer did not get the death penalty was because the Florida Supreme Court had said that the death penalty was unconstitutional. That's
right.
Why he had to serve life in prison, which is, to me, so wrong. Rodriguez did to Schaefer was justifiable.
Right.
Because,
I mean, the only thing that I hate, though, is because there is a detective, Curcio, who continued to try to follow the case, and he has indicated to my brother and I that he had was actually directly planning another interview with him to try to get additional information right before that murder. So unfortunately, there's no way to guarantee that Gerard Schaefer would have talked, because I think he liked to play a lot of games and he seemed to enjoy the cat and mouse effect. So whether he would have been forthcoming with information, you know, we'll never know, because he really wasn't always doing that unless there was something in it for him. But it would have ever been nice for us to maybe learn a little more or get more if he would have been willing. But I know that he played the game quite well for a lot of years without giving up much.
Well, a friend of mine who, Ron Hazelwood, who was an FBI agent, who he and another few men set up the profiling for serial killers, he corresponded with Schaefer in prison. And I have those letters, and it's interesting, when Roy would ask Schaefer a question, Schaefer would come back with, well, I tell you what, I'll give you Biscolani and Farmer if you give me this. Do you think I really did it? And you know he did it, but he was such a narcissistic sociopath that he was going to play the game regardless, because he thought he was smarter than the average bear.
Right. And it's like his books that he wrote, those very sick books that were taken out of circulation, the killer fiction books or whatever.
Yes.
I would tend to believe that those were probably just for his enjoyment to relive the things he did, although he never would admit that they were true confessions. I mean, I really think that obviously there was probably more to it than just him deciding to have a literary talent, you know. But I'm glad they took those out of circulation, because I would hate to think that he would get to enjoy that again, you know, and profit and benefit at that time.
Well, when my husband and the other investigators, when they went down to Schaefer's mother's house to serve the search warrant and they found the writings, that was one of the circumstantial evidence pieces that they used to convict him with, even though he kept saying that it was his own imagination. And when I was researching the book, I found a copy of Killer Fiction, and I read it, and not a whole lot bothers me, because I've seen a lot in my life, but I wanted to dig him up and kill him myself. But I'm reading this book, and it's got all of the case files on these girls, and I look at my husband Jack, and I said, these are confessions. And what serial killers do, ladies and gentlemen, is they keep trophies, because they kill for the, it's a power thing, and it's self-gratification. It has nothing to do with sex. It has nothing to do with anything except power and self-gratification. So what Schaefer would do is he would torture these girls, then he would kill them, then he would commit necrophilia with them, and he would relive it in his writings, and he'd get that high again, that adrenaline rush, and then when it would start to wane, he would go out and do it again. And if he could have been caught, let me take a step back, Eva. If he had been put in jail immediately for the two that got away, your sister would not have been killed.
Exactly. That's exactly right. That is exactly. And that brings a great deal of bitterness. Because with what they told and what he did to them and how scary that was, there should have been no bail.
And he should not have been allowed the 3 months to get his affairs in order. But again, because there had been no communication, there had been no back and forth with the other police departments, as a matter of courtesy, the judge said, okay, go take your wife down to Fort Lauderdale, ladies and gentlemen. This is where his mother was from. This is where he was from. He knew the area. Go take your wife down there, get your affairs in order, and report for jail in March. Well, he had 3 months to continue his killings, and that's when he killed his last 6 victims.
Right, right.
And so,
and it's like he was getting fast and furious. Maybe he knew he was going to be locked up. Maybe he knew. I don't know, but he definitely
was angry.
Has never been able to do that. Yes,
he was very angry.
Whenever you look at, whenever I read the stories of what he did to those two girls that got away, I mean, how frightening and scary. He knew exactly what he was doing. Had clearly done it before. I mean, that. Whenever those girls described that behavior to another police officer, every red flag in everybody's entire central nervous system should have gone off.
If there had been the communication, and the only reason that he finally was caught or prosecuted for any murders was when they found Georgia Jessup and Susan Place on the island, and that the MO was similar to what Trotter and Wells had gone through. Had those two bodies not been found, he probably would have continued killing.
He probably would have. Because I'm sure we both know he would have killed until they caught him on something.
Absolutely. And the thing is, because this part of the county was still very remote, and as well as in some places in Fort Lauderdale, and he knew all the remote places, so he knew where to take those girls where he wouldn't be bothered, and he knew where to leave them. Now, I know you told me that you could only be on here for 30 minutes. Do you want to continue?
Right.
Okay.
I apologize, but I'm not going to be able to continue. So, but I did just want to call in and thank you and be a part of your program and just get Debbie's name out there and hope that somewhere, some way, somebody knows anything and that they will be willing to share it with you.
Well, honey, I know this. No, I cannot say with a certainty that I know it was difficult. I understand it was difficult. I don't know that I can do it. You're a very courageous young woman. And I am honored and I am humbled that you were able to do this. I am sorry that Leroy couldn't do it, and I know that he's very, very affected by it, and it's very difficult for him.
Yes, yes.
But I so appreciate you and your courage and your strength and your love for your sister and your siblings and your parents, because y'all are victims too and will continue to be victims.
Well, we thank you, Yvonne. We thank you for everything you're doing and everything you will do. We just appreciate anyone being willing to take an interest in Debbie and all of those girls and try to continue their plight and to bring them closure and recognition and just try to help us in any way. It's so much appreciated. Thank you.
You're welcome, sweetheart, and thank you for being on the show.
Thank you. You have a wonderful evening.
You too, honey. Good night.
Good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Eva Newsom. I'm going to continue the show because this book is very important. The backstory of this book is my husband, Jack Sewell, is retired from the 19th Judicial Circuit. He was their lead investigator. And when I first moved to Florida in 2006, Jack took me on a tour of South Hutchinson Island. And he told me the story of Susan Place and Georgia Jessup, and told me what Schaefer had done and how he had knocked their teeth out and kept some of them as trophies, and the horrendous crime that this man had committed. Being the person that I am, my degree is in criminal justice with an interest, a very big interest in serial killers. In fact, my final term paper was on Jack the Ripper. It bothered me because I asked him, I said, has anybody ever written about these girls? And he said, not that I knew of. So I came home and I started my research and I started looking. And nobody even knew who Gerard Schaefer was. Sure, his name was out there, but it was out there in a, I must say, hero worship way. And there was a lot of misinformation. And I said, this can't happen. These girls deserve better than this. The youngest girl was 8. The oldest was 22. Schaefer started killing in 1966. And I researched the book. I spent hours and hours and months and weeks. I spent a year on this book. I interviewed investigators. I interviewed the now state attorney for the 19th Judicial Circuit, who at the time was the second chief for the defense. I pulled research. I got psyche vows. Roy Hazelwood sent me letters that Schaefer had written him. And the more that I studied this man, and the more I read about these girls, and some of these girls' bodies have never, ever been found, and probably never will be. There's probably a house or business or a residence before the burial place is. It broke my heart, because just like Eva and her family, they want answers, and they deserve answers. The child was taken away from them way too soon, and they deserve answers. They deserve to be able to mentally and emotionally move on in their life. So I wrote Silent Scream, and I told the story. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this book is not sanitized. I'm going to tell you right now. It is not pretty. If you have a weak stomach, or if you want to know what their favorite toy was, or what their favorite dress was, or what their best friend's name was, or who their boyfriend was, you're not going to get it in this book. Because this book talks about what happened to them, and how it happened to them, and why it happened to them. It is not a book for the faint of heart. It is written along the lines of criminal justice. It is not a happily ever after, and no, there are no final answers. So if that's what you're looking for, don't read it. But if you want to understand on some level the evil that Gerard James Schaefer did to these beautiful girls, then read it. It will give you nightmares. When I was researching this book and I was working on this book, I didn't sleep. I couldn't sleep because the girls were all the time talking to me. They couldn't get their story out fast enough. I couldn't type it fast enough. And I finally went to sleep one night. And then a few minutes later, I was sound asleep. I sat straight up in bed. And this voice said, "I am going to kill you." And I said, "No, you're not. You're dead. You cannot touch me." And it was Schaefer. And I knew his voice because I've watched him enough on his interviews. I knew his voice. He was trying to frighten me to keep me from finishing the girl's story. And I refused to allow him to do it. Let me tell you what Rodriguez did to Schaefer in prison. Again, the death penalty in the state of Florida had been ruled unconstitutional. So Schaefer got life on Georgia Joseph and Susan Close. They wanted to go back and prosecute him for all the others, but there was not enough evidence. And Bob Stone, the prosecutor at the time, said he would rather have Schaefer in prison on the two rather than him back out on the street for lack of evidence on the other seven. So Schaefer decides that because he was a former cop and he was a con artist, he managed to get a water tank in the pod where they were, and they could get a cup of hot water for their soup or their coffee or whatever, and each prisoner could get one a day. Because Schaefer had been instrumental in supposedly getting that in the pod, he thought he deserved two. In the meantime, he was playing jailhouse lawyer with all of the inmates, and he would convince them to talk to him about their crimes. And they would spill all this stuff to him, everything they had done, thought about doing, or were going to do, and he would in turn tell whatever cop listened in whatever day. He knew he could never get out, but he thought that he would at least get some special favors. There was an inmate named Rodriguez, who even the guards were afraid of. Even his own psychiatrist was afraid of him. This man was just evil incarnate. He got enough of Schaefer's snitching. So one morning at 8 o'clock in the morning, Schaefer had gone out of his cell and had come back to his cell, and Rodriguez was in Schaefer's cell. Rodriguez stabbed Schaefer 18 times in his eyes. He also cut him from one end of his mouth to the other, from ear to ear. The message that was sent was, you can't snitch anymore and you can't see anymore. Justice was served in a very cruel and violent way, and Schaefer did die in prison. And the brutality and the violence of his death, the small recompense for what he had done to these girls, because what he would do, ladies and gentlemen, and I said this at the first of the show, he would convince these girls to get in the car with him. Then he would take them to a remote location, and he would handcuff them. He would gag them. Then he would stand on an upturned bucket or on the root of a mango tree, and he would taunt them after he hung them. And of course, if they stepped off the root of the tree, they would suffocate, they would hang, and he would taunt them. And then he would do two girls at once, and he would turn to one girl and he would say, "Okay, which one of you want to die, and I'll let the other one go. Tell me, which one of you want to die? Y'all discuss it among yourselves, and then I'll let whichever one I kill, then the other one can go home." Knowing all the time he wasn't going to do that. He was going to kill both of them. He would go off and leave them hanging there in these remote areas for hours And then he would come back and he would torture them some more and he would taunt them some more. And these girls would be bitten by mosquitoes and gnats and no-see-ums. They'd be sunburnt. They'd be thirsty. They'd be hungry. They would probably wet and defecate on themselves because, of course, there was no way they could get in the bathroom. So the mental torture, the physical torture, and the emotional torture, he enjoyed it. And he would sit on another bucket in front of him, and he would have conversation with him. And then finally he would shoot him. And he would bury them after he knocked out their teeth. And then he would commit necrophilia. Then he'd bury him again and come back. He would continue to do that until the rot was so bad that the body would just fall apart. Then he would relive it for days, weeks, months, until the adrenaline rush was gone. Then he'd go do it again. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if you've never lost a child, you cannot understand the sense of total loss, the sense of guilt, the sense of emptiness, the what-ifs, the shoulda-woulda-couldas. The parents suffer because no parent should bury their child. No parent should have to wonder where that child's body is. But Schaefer didn't care. He only cared about himself. He only cared about the power that he had. Because, see, ladies and gentlemen, he thought, in his mind, that these girls were whores and drug addicts, and that they actually wanted to die, and he was doing them a favor by doing to them what he did to them, and that they appreciated it and they wanted it. And this is the narcissistic sociopath attitude that this man had. He really believed his own evil, and his reality was in his mind. There was not a shred of good in this man. He started tearing wings off of flies and shooting sand crabs and small animals when he was 12 years old. He also was into erotic hanging, where he would go down to the local hangout with another group of people that did this, and they would put on women's underwear, and they would hang themselves until they climaxed. The man was evil. So, people always thought Ted Bundy was the first serial killer that was out there. No. Gerard Schaefer was before Bundy. Bundy got the notoriety because Bundy, A, got sloppy, and T, Bundy left the bodies from Texas to Florida. And then they thought Danny Rollins was the second serial killer. No, Danny Rollins was the third serial killer. But Gerard Schaefer got lost in the shuffle. And so did his victims. And that's what's painful, is these girls got lost in the shuffle because nobody knew about them. The first two victims disappeared at Penn Prairie Preserve. He was seen carrying a body into the preserve. But the woman that saw him to this didn't know. And of course, there were no cell phones. So she went to the local police station. Police went to where she saw the car. When they got there, he was gone. She became an alcoholic because of what she saw. So Schaefer, once again, left victims. Again. His wife was a victim. The prosecutor's family were victims because he threatened to kill them all. The defense attorney was a victim because he threatened to kill him. He threatened to kill my husband. He threatened to kill every investigator that worked his crimes because he said he had connections. The only connections he had was getting his throat slit in prison. But he really believed that he had connections. At the end of every show, I do a roll call because it's important that these men stay with you. And you pray for their families every night. One of the victim's mother still lives in the same house and still has the same phone number because she believes her daughter will come home. Her body was never found. From a roll call of this, Nancy Litton, Pam Nader, Lee Hamlin Bundy's, Carmen Marie Halleck, who left a small child. She never got to see her daughter grow up. Wendy Brown Stevenson and Peggy Ryan. Deborah Sulu. Belinda Hutchins. Alice Biscolani. And Elsie Lena Farmer. Those are the 9 victims that I knew of. And, of course, Nancy Trotter and Pamela Sue Wells, who fortunately were the catalyst that got Schaefer caught. Ladies and gentlemen, anyone on any given day can be abducted and disappear forever, and in many cases never be found. There are sociopaths and serial killers that live among us and carry on everyday lives. Gerard Schaefer was a sheriff's deputy for Martin County Sheriff's Department. Before that, he worked at Wilton Mills as a sheriff's deputy. As a police officer, so he worked for the police department. So they act normal, and they do walk among us. And they are dangerous. And people hurt because of them. So, when you're approached by a stranger, be aware. Don't get in close with strangers. We have the technology now, cell phones and AAA. You don't have to get in a car with a stranger. Watch your back, watch your family's back, watch your friends' back. And if nothing else is learned from this, learn to love your family and your friends. Don't leave the house without saying you love them. Because Deborah's family did not know that when she walked to school that day, that she would never return. When Reverend saw his sister walk out the door that night, or walk past him to go to her school, and watched her until she disappeared from sight, that she would never return. So, be careful out there. Take care of yourself and take care of your family. Silent Scream. Get it, order it, read it. Commit it to memory. Keep these girls alive. Keep their memory alive. Because they deserve it. They did not deserve to be forgotten. Tomorrow night, author George Kramer will be on our show. First time guest. Can't wait to talk to that young man. And then on Friday night, we're going to have Andy Keller on. She was the one that was supposed to be on last Saturday night. She had an emergency that I don't blame her. I would have forgot about the show, too. Her son had a blood clot in his arm. They thought that it would go to his heart. So they rushed him to the ER, and she was profusely apologized and told her she didn't have to. I would have done the same thing as all of us, I'm sure would. So she's going to come on Friday night and talk to me. Now, I didn't, at the beginning of the show, I didn't tell you guys where we're heard, because I wanted to get into the show and I knew that Ava had to leave. We are well over 10,000 listeners all over the world, ladies and gentlemen, and I mean that literally all over the world. We're heard in Hungary, Bulgaria, Ukraine, Finland, Sweden, Korea, Ecuador, Tunisia, the Netherlands, Norway, Malaysia, Vietnam, Russian Federation, Singapore, of course, the USA, Ireland, Germany, Egypt, the UK, Indonesia, Australia, and I have to give a shout out to Australia. 72% of my listeners are from down under. Thank you, guys. That is wonderful. Canada, Croatia, New Zealand, Brazil, Taiwan, South Africa, Pakistan, India, Saudi Arabia, Portugal, and Nigeria. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to be on the show, all you have to do is contact me. OffTheChainRadio@yahoo.com. I'll get you on the show. Whether you have a book, a music, art, platform, business, or you just want to talk, I'll get you on the show. No problem. Also, under my married name, Yvonne Sewell, go to V.com and type in Yvonne Sewell. Some of my artwork is now on clothing, totes, shawls, wraps, and purses. Check it out, Vida, V-I-D-A.com, all capital letters. Viewbug.com, that's where all my photographs are. If you like photographs, you can go on Viewbug.com, and many, many of my photographs are for sale. There will be a lot more for sale as soon as I get in there and change the setting to 7. Please, Mama needs to buy a brand new pair of shoes. If you missed the show on Monday night, we played the Teske Brothers music. They are from Down Under. They are a soul blues band, so check that out in archives. And I always close my show with this, ladies and gentlemen. And sadly, these young women did not get to live their dream, because not only was their dream stolen, their life was stolen. So, we all are dreamers. You have a dream. Don't wait. And don't let anybody steal it from you. It's your dream. You own it. They don't. Make your dream happen. This radio show is a dream. Five-year dream. My books are a dream. My photographs are a dream. The only thing I never dreamed would happen was that my photographs would be on clothing and pocketbooks and totes and shawls and wraps and t-shirts. That would fall in my lap because I use my talents. So I get blessed with my talents. Do not discourage your children from dreaming. If they come to you and say, Mama, I want to be a rocket scientist, say, okay, how can I help you? What do I need to do? Mama, I want to be a musician. How can I help you? What do you need to do? And if you're in school and your teacher says, well, you can't do that, what you do is you say, just watch me. If you don't believe me, just watch. Bruno Mars. Because you are your own success maker. You grab that dream and you run with it like you stole it. If we didn't have dreamers, we wouldn't have people on the moon. We wouldn't have people in outer space. We wouldn't have people in submarines under the water. We wouldn't have music and art. We wouldn't have technology. We wouldn't have the printed word. We wouldn't have automobiles. We wouldn't have bicycles. We wouldn't have handheld phones. We wouldn't even have electricity without dreamers. So, be a dreamer. Own that dream. And when people try to steal it from you, get rid of them like a bad habit. Because you do not need negative in your life. Please go and buy Silent Scream. Keep the girls' memory alive for the families. And don't be that person. Don't live with regrets. Because you never know what might happen. Always do your dreams. Always, always, always live your dreams. You want to jump out of a perfect good airplane? Go for it. You want to race a motorcycle? Go for it. Because we only go around once. And if we come back again, it's not, we don't have the same dreams. So, ladies and gentlemen, join me tomorrow night at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, right here, off the chain, with my guest, George. Love yourselves, love each other, and I'll see you tomorrow night.